Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Continuing to read from presidential historian Michael Betschloss's Presidents of War and his essay on President Harry S. Truman and the Korean War. We pick up the story in January 1953 as President Truman's presidency comes to an end. The Korean War is still ongoing, and the new president is Dwight D. Eisenhower. 5 days before leaving office in January 1953, President Truman delivered a televised farewell address from the Oval Office. He called waging war in Korea the most important decision of his presidency. Recalling his own service in World War I, Truman said he knew what a soldier goes through and the anguish of military families. Now Americans were living in the eighth year of the atomic age, and a third world war might dig the grave not only of our communist opponents, but also of our own society. Truman professed not a doubt in the world that free countries would prevail. Prophetically, he forecast, stating, "As the Soviet hopes for an easy expansion are blocked, then there will have to come a time of change in the Soviet world. Nobody can say for sure when that is going to be, or exactly how it will come about, whether by revolution, or trouble in the satellite states, or by a change inside the Kremlin." Truman reminded Americans that starting an atomic war is totally unthinkable for rational men. On Inauguration Day, when the Eisenhower's limousine rolled up at the north portico of the White House, the Trumans were waiting inside to host them for coffee. However, still stewing over what he considered to be the president's aspirations, the general and his wife, Mamie Eisenhower, declined to come into the White House. During the frigid ride up Capitol Hill, by Truman's account, Eisenhower grumpily asked who had tried to embarrass him by calling his son John Eisenhower back from combat in Korea to attend the inauguration. Truman had done so out of graciousness, told Ike that it had been his decision. As president, Eisenhower sought to break the deadlock Panmunjom talks by sending secret messages to the Chinese through at least three different diplomatic channels, including Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru of India, that if the Korea War did not end soon, the United States might turn to the ultimate weapon. But at least as important was Stalin's death in March of 1953. The old tyrant had been secretly advising Mao Zedong to drag out the Korean War and thus damage the military prestige of the United States and Great Britain. "Americans don't know how to fight," Joseph Stalin had told Zhou Enlai in 1952. "They are pinning their hopes on the atom power and air power, but one cannot win a war with that." 2 weeks after Joseph Stalin's death, his heirs secretly advised both Mao and Kim Il-sung of Korea that the deepest interests of our peoples compelled the soonest possible conclusion of the Korean War. By June 1953, China relaxed its positions on POWs, which opened the way to a settlement. The two sides agreed to a heavily armed truce, with the peninsula of Korea divided at the 38th parallel, amid a formal state of war that remains to this day. President Eisenhower was convinced that his secret nuclear threat had made the difference. He later called the Korean armistice his proudest achievement as president. Learning of the truce in Independence, Missouri, Truman told reporters that he was certainly glad. Still nursing his grievances against Eisenhower, however, he conservatively added, "I sincerely hope, and I want to underline that word hope, that it means peace." At his best, President Truman had supervised the final American efforts of World War II, approving the use of atomic weapons to close down the Japanese conflict and resisted Soviet power in Europe. But Truman and Secretary of State Dean Acheson erred by sending Moscow and Beijing unintended signals that the United States might not protect South Korea, which helped to provoke a war that ultimately killed at least 33,686 American soldiers and more than 1.2 million people on all sides. It does not speak well for Truman, who liked to boast about his forthrightness and his eagerness to accept personal responsibility for his mistakes, that in Years of Trial and Hope, his second volume of memoirs, published in 1956, Truman shifted the blame to others and claimed that the Korean conflict had been inevitable. Refusing to concede that he or Acheson had done anything that might have enticed the North Koreans to invade South Korea, Truman claimed to have been confronted almost spontaneously by the ominous threat of a Third World War, adding that his decision to intervene in Korea had been the toughest of his presidency. Having closely studied the Constitution, Truman had strongly defended congressional prerogatives while a senator. But when the Korean fighting began, he refused to ask Congress for a war declaration, privately arguing that doing so would enmesh him in damaging controversy on Capitol Hill, and noting that, by using force to defend the South, he had the right to act as a member of the United Nations. Truman's refusal, and the willingness of Congress and the courts to put up with it, established a dangerous excuse for every later president to avoid asking the House and Senate for war declarations. It also gave some of Truman's congressional foes an opening to call his action in Korea illegitimate and unworthy of support. Having failed to deter the North Korean invasion, the first major such event after World War II, Truman would have had a difficult time convincing the world that the post-war international order meant very much unless he responded as he did with force. For the early period of the Korean War, Truman subcontracted too much of his decision-making to the legendary General Douglas MacArthur. However, by firing the insubordinate commander, he gave future presidents a substantial gift by reestablishing civilian control of the military. With political courage, for he knew it would jeopardize his popularity, Truman put the nation on a war footing, asking Americans to make sacrifices that would hasten rearmament and support the troops in battle. Korea was the first American war of the nuclear age, and Truman successfully kept it from escalating. When it became clear to him that the conflict was destined to end at best in deadlock unless he used nuclear weapons, Truman had the good judgment to cut his losses. But this president could never quite explain to Americans exactly why they were at war in Korea, nor did he try hard enough. This left some to suspect that the only reason the nation could have gotten stuck in a losing war in Korea was that the federal government was honeycombed with Soviet secret agents. It was not by coincidence that Senator Joe McCarthy of Wisconsin made such headway just as Americans were hearing about setbacks in Korea. When U.S. soldiers were mired during that first winter of this war, citizens back home turned against it, and the president responsible for it, with astounding speed, especially at a time when so many Americans were naturally disposed to believe in their president. Although 1.5 million American men were drafted to possibly fight and die in this increasingly unpopular war, there were no large-scale protests, including on campuses and in the colleges. With Korea, Truman started an American tradition under which a circumscribed group of Americans gave their lives for a purpose that was never well explained, while the rest of the citizenry went on almost as normal. It was fortunate for Truman that he served at a time of a largely quiescent public who had intense trust in American institutions. How to account for the fact that Truman's war leadership, from his failure to ask Congress for a war declaration through his attempted steel seizure, showed such impatience with the checks and balances imposed on the executive by the U.S. Constitution? At least superficially, this was surprising from a leader who loved the founders, had taken 2 years of night law school in Kansas City, Missouri, and been a member of the Senate Club. But Truman's personal experience of the wartime presidency had consisted of watching Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt wage two global conflicts, and then closing down World War II as president, all of which encouraged him to act imperiously. It seems never to have registered with Truman that Korea was a very different kind of war from anything Americans had fought before, which should have compelled him to regard it with far more personal modesty and respect for constitutional constraints. Almost instantly after the armistice was signed in 1953, the Korean War moved away from the center of the nation's consciousness. Even though Americans had all been affected in some way by the conflict, they seemed eager to forget that their country had not prevailed. Eisenhower, who wished to heal the country and ensure peace and prosperity, had little incentive to relitigate the issue of Truman's failures in Korea. Eisenhower wished to turn the page from time when so many members of his party had been enchanted by the poison of Senator Joe McCarthy and the isolationism of Senator Robert Taft of Ohio, who died in 1953. Democrats, too, wished to escape the partisan bitterness of the Korean period, as well as Truman's unpopularity. By the early 1960s, majorities in both parties were content to let the Asian conflict remain a forgotten war. Unwilling to take to heart the mistakes that Truman and other politicians had made over Korea, the American people and those who guided them were thus all the more doomed to rush into the darkness of Vietnam. This concludes Michael Beschloss's essay on President Harry Truman and the Korean War in his book, Presidents of War. This begins Michael Beschloss's essay in his book, Presidents of War, on the presidency of Lyndon Baines Johnson and the Vietnam War, his essay entitled, We Got Slapped. On Sunday afternoon, August 2, 1964, Captain George Morrison, commander of a carrier division on the Gulf of Tonkin off North Vietnam, was at the helm of his flagship, a U.S. aircraft carrier called the Bonhomme Richard. Morrison was informed that one of his vessels, the destroyer Maddox, had been assaulted by North Vietnamese motor torpedo boats while collecting signals intelligence and had fired back. As a young Navy ensign at Pearl Harbor, Morrison had witnessed the Japanese attack that brought the United States into World War II. Now the Georgia-born captain was at the center of another moment in history that would draw his country into war. Captain Morrison's long assignments at sea during the Korean War and later had been hard on his family, especially his son Jimmy, who is now a film student at the University of California, Los Angeles. When the Bonhomme Richard aircraft carrier stopped in San Diego in January 1964, Jimmy's mother, Clara, implored Jimmy not to arrive looking like a beatnik. The son got a trim, but the captain ordered the vessel's barber to give his son a crew cut like his own. From aboard ship, at his father's demand, Jimmy fired an M16 at human effigies hurled into the ocean. A year later, Jimmy broke the news to the captain that he was going on the road with a rock band. George replied, "That's ridiculous. You are not a singer. You can't sing, and get yourself a job." Jim Morrison gained fame in the world as a lead singer for the Doors and falsely told reporters that both of his parents were dead. Like a fast increasing share of his generation, Jim Morrison hated the war in Vietnam, to which his father was devoted. And as the conflict spiraled, one song, which the Doors recorded in January 1968, captured Jim Morrison's anger. It was called The Unknown Soldier. After the sound of troops marching could be heard, an officer's shout, "Present arms," a drum roll and a rifle fire, and Jim Morrison's mournful voice singing, "Breakfast where the news is read, bullet strikes the helmet's head, and it's all over." In August 1964, with only 15,500 U.S. advisors in South Vietnam, the full blast of anti-war rage was in the future, as a report of an attack on the destroyer Maddox sped from the Tonkin Gulf to the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. On that Sunday in Washington, President Lyndon Baines Johnson took his breakfast upstairs in the White House at 9 o'clock in the morning. 2 hours later, wearing a narrow tie and his World War II Silver Star in his suit lapel, Johnson was summoned to the Oval Office in the White House for an urgent meeting with a half-dozen officials, including his Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, alumnus of Truman's War in Korea. "Where are my Bundys?" Johnson genially asked, referring to his National Security Advisor, McGeorge Bundy, and Bundy's brother William, Assistant Secretary of State for Asia. Johnson joked, "They're up there at the female island of theirs, Martha's Vineyard." Then he asked, "What's the big emergency?" Secretary of State Dean Rusk described what he was already calling the unprovoked attack in the Tonkin Gulf in Vietnam. Told of the fragmentary evidence that North Vietnamese patrol boats had assaulted the destroyer Maddox, the president asked, "We weren't up to any mischief out there, were we?" What Johnson meant was the secret OPLAN-34A program, which he had approved as a new president after John F. Kennedy's assassination, covert U.S. attacks against North Vietnamese targets. In March, Johnson had asked George McBundy to keep them off base and upset them a little bit without getting another Korean operation started. Someone now conceded to the president that there might indeed have been such a raid a few nights before the Maddox was struck. For Johnson, the moment was politically sensitive. The previous month, the Republicans had chosen Senator Barry Goldwater of Arizona to oppose him that fall in the election in 1964. Accepting his party's nomination at San Francisco's Cow Palace, Barry Goldwater had complained that failures infest the jungles of Vietnam. "Yesterday it was Korea, tonight it is Vietnam. Don't try to sweep this under the rug. We are at war in Vietnam." And yet the president, who is the commander-in-chief of our armed forces, refuses to say whether or not the objective over there is victory. This morning, President Johnson did not seem anxious that the Maddox incident would amount to much. Presuming that the North Vietnamese were simply responding to a covert U.S. raid, he told his advisors that it reminded him of being in a movie theater, stating, "You're sitting next to a pretty girl, and you have your hand on her ankle, and nothing happens. And you move it up to her knee, and nothing happens. You move it up further, and you're thinking about moving it a bit more, and all of a sudden, you get slapped. I think we got slapped." Thomas Hughes, the State Department's intelligence chief, scrawled Dean Rusk a note asking whether, now that we know what happened in the movies in Texas, did he still intend to call the Maddox attack unprovoked. Rusk put the question to Secretary of Defense Cyrus Vance, who said that of course it was unprovoked because the Maddox had been sailing in international waters. "Well, it seems a bit murky, and we won't have any retaliation," said President Johnson, stating, "but we will warn them against doing anything further." He would issue a public statement the next day, vowing to send another destroyer to the Tonkin Gulf, along with combat air patrol, explaining that in the future, any force which attacks them in international waters would be attacked with the goal of destroying it. Now dispensing with the Maddox incident, he abruptly changed the subject and asked his gathering of national security experts at some length about a pending postal pay bill. Scratching his head, Johnson's new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Earl Wheeler, asked a colleague while leaving the meeting, "Is it always like this?" At 9:46 on Monday morning, President Johnson addressed the Maddox incident during a telephone conversation with his old Texas friend, Robert Anderson, who had been Dwight D. Eisenhower's Secretary of the Treasury. He said, "There have been some covert operations in that area that we have been carrying on, blowing up some bridges and things of that kind, so I imagine they wanted to put a stop to it." After the North Vietnamese had fired, the Navy had responded immediately with 5-inch guns from the destroyer and with planes overhead. Johnson added to Anderson, what happened was we'd been playing around up there, and they came out, gave us a warning, and we knocked hell out of them. Anderson warned Johnson, "You're going to be running against a man who's a wild man on this subject." He urged the president to declare that when they shoot at us from the back, we're not soft, and we're going to protect ourselves. We'll protect our boys. Referring to his public statement, Johnson asked Anderson, "Didn't it leave that impression?" Anderson replied, "I haven't heard any adverse criticism from anybody." But he cautioned that Barry Goldwater would exploit the Vietnam issue, stating, "I just know that this fellow is going to play all of the angles." Lyndon Johnson was born in the Texas Hill Country in 1908. He and his siblings were taught by their deeply literate mother, Rebecca, about the importance of books. Soon after becoming president, Johnson reminisced to Isabel Shelton, a social reporter for the Washington Star newspaper, about how his mother, Rebecca, just had the bed full of them and read out loud to all of us all the time, from Browning, Tennyson, and biographies of Texas Governors Jim Hogue and Jim Ferguson, as well as Presidents Andrew Jackson and Abraham Lincoln. Lyndon Johnson recalled that the first president I really loved was Andrew Jackson, because he didn't let them tread on him. And then Woodrow Wilson, everything he wrote or said, I memorized nearly. Johnson's keen boyhood interest in history did not survive into adulthood. Despite his faith in the value of education, he was too much in a professional hurry to teach himself much history he did not personally experience. As a rising politician with a flypaper memory, Johnson felt that he learned more from his encounters with a wide range of people. The result was startling gaps in his knowledge of the American past. For instance, during a telephone conversation in 1964 with a political friend, Johnson would say, "Remember this? Lincoln went back to Springfield, Missouri after he was president." That same year, USID of Time magazine tried to find out whether Johnson actually consumed the large number of books alleged by his staff. When Sidey asked him for examples, aide after aide mentioned the same book, and Barbara Ward's The Rich Nations and the Poor Nations. Johnson loved the romance of Texas folklore. During his Hill Country youth, there were still a few surviving Mexican War veterans who told of the Alamo and the later battlefield gallantry that had expanded the nation's continental reach. Johnson's great-grandfather, Reverend George Washington Baines, was a lifelong friend of Sam Houston, after whom Lyndon Johnson's father was named. When Martin Luther King Jr. came to the White House, President Johnson showed him a famed letter from Houston to his ancestor, praising Baines for his help to wrest Texas away from Mexico. In 1964, Johnson reminded a Nashville audience that while Davy Crockett may have been born on a mountaintop, in the words of the ballad from the 1950s Walt Disney TV series, Crockett won his final glory by dying at the Alamo. Out of respect for the Texas military tradition, when young Johnson was elected to the House of Representatives as a Roosevelt acolyte in 1937, he asked the president to help him get on to the House Naval Affairs Committee. Roosevelt personally clinched the deal. In the late 1930s, Johnson backed his president's efforts to nudge the country towards intervention. But as he much later recalled, he loved peace so much that he signed a discharge petition to let the House debate and vote on the Ludlow Amendment, excreted by Roosevelt, which would have required a national referendum before the country could go to war. Defending his youthful mistake, Johnson later said, "Of course, that was the day before the nuclear bomb, but it was crazy even then because I had no information to vote on it." In June 1940, Johnson enlisted in the Naval Reserve. When he announced for the U.S. Senate in a special election the following year, Johnson pledged, "If the day ever comes when my vote must be cast to send your boys to the trenches, that day Lyndon Johnson will leave his Senate seat to go with him. He would never vote for a war and then hide behind his Senate seat where bullets cannot reach me." Johnson was defeated by only 1,311 votes. President Roosevelt told him half-jokingly that in the future, he had better learn to sit on ballot boxes to prevent fraud after the votes were cast. After Pearl Harbor, Johnson, still a congressman, told reporters that he hankered for active duty with the fleet upon the attack by what he called the Sabbath Day Assassins. President Roosevelt had Johnson dispatched as a Navy observer to study the beleaguered Allied effort in the combat zone of Australia. The congressman left the management of his health office to Lady Bird, his wife. In June 1942, after a briefing by General MacArthur in Melbourne, Lieutenant Commander Johnson and two other observers who were vetting air and ground forces were flown to Garbutt Field, the launching base for aerial attacks against the Japanese in New Guinea. Johnson was to fly on a B-26 Marauder called the Wabash Cannonball, but his place was taken at the last minute by Lieutenant Colonel Francis Stevens, one of his fellow observers, so he walked across the airstrip and asked the commander of another B-26, the Hackling Hare, if he could fly with his crew. The Hare's tail gunner, Corporal Harry Barron, warned Johnson that it would be rough and he might get shot up. By Johnson's later account, an hour after takeoff, Japanese Zero fighter planes swarmed all around the Hackling Hare, which is struck by bullets and cannon shells, damaging the generator that drove the plane's right engine. Describing the barrage, the Hare's radio gunman, Lilius Walker, later said, "You're looking right into the face of death when that happens." According to Walker, Congressman Johnson was calm and watching everything. When the Hare sat down, Johnson smiled and told the crew, "It's been very interesting." Soon he was told that the Wabash Cannonball under attack had crashed into the ocean with no survivors. This concludes the reading of Michael Beschloss's essay on President Johnson and the Vietnam War, entitled "We Got Slapped," and it will be continued. This is Wallace Klingdienst, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.